Welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 206. Thank you so much for watching and tuning in. Hope you've had a great week this week. We're going to get back into talking about Nixon. I'm going to break down some things about him. Not only him, the cabal, the industrial elite that found Nixon, supported him throughout his political career, and then after he became president, these people took him out. But I'm going to pick up that in a moment. I want to cover a little bit about this foreign aid bill that was passed by the Senate. Joe Biden signed it, and it's law now. $61 billion, roughly $61 billion to Ukraine, another 25 or so, 25, 26 billion to Israel, Gaza. Then there's also another $8 billion to the Indo-Pacific, is what it says. I guess so, Taiwan, the Indo-Pacific. A lot of stuff in this bill, major bill. Let's get started in this podcast. I want to start with Mitch McConnell. And if you remember, I guess it was last week sometime, I did the podcast, Isolationist was the title of the podcast. And I was talking about how the term isolationist came about, and it's a derogatory term to paint people who don't want all of this money going to foreign wars and are against the military-industrial complex, and you know, people that want peace. Isolationists is what they call these people, particularly in the Republican Party. And Mitch McConnell was saying that in his last days in the Senate, that he really wants to root out this this element of isolationism in his party. Bro, you will die before you root out this movement in the Republican Party, because it is a movement. And it didn't come from Trump. If you want to blame anyone, you can blame Ron Paul, because Ron Paul, in my opinion, but it even goes back beyond Ron Paul to people like Pat Buchanan, people like, what's his name? The guy who ran in 92 against Clinton and Bush, Perot, others. I mean, this has been a small element in the conservative movement for a long time, but it started to grow after Ron Paul's run, particularly in 2012. And then Trump came along and took the reins. But this has been growing for a long period of time. So Mitch McConnell was asked, after this bill was passed in the Senate, this foreign aid bill, what took this bill so long to get passed? And I want you to take a listen to what Mitch McConnell says.
Shortly after the vote, Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who's been one of Kyiv's strongest advocates in Washington, offered this stark assessment of why many in his party had turned on Ukraine.
I think the demonization of Ukraine began by Tucker Carlson, who, in my opinion, ended up where he should have been all along, which is interviewing Vladimir Putin.
So it was Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson's fault for all of the backlash against the Ukraine funding and the war in Ukraine and the isolationism. So Tucker Carlson is a real problem for these people. If I was him, I, you know, would be very careful, because the military-industrial complex, and I think about this sometimes, even, you know, with some of the things that I talk about on this podcast, and some of the things we're going to talk about today. These people are murderers. People joke about Arkanside and the Clintons, and how they murder people. I mean, it's bigger than that. These people are murderers. So anyway, my podcast isn't that big as of yet, but I do worry about these people because they are murderers and they will murder to keep the dollars rolling in. I mean, if they would murder the president of the United States, as you know, we talked about on Monday about what happened in Dallas in November of 1963. I mean, someone like Tucker Carlson, someone like me, many others who I can name who have been murdered, I can name them. Yeah, I mean, anyway, it's Tucker Carlson's fault that people are against the Ukraine war, and it has nothing to do with the fact that we're $35 trillion in debt, Mitch McConnell, or that thousands of people are dying, and we don't, it has nothing to do with any of those issues. It's Tucker Carlson, because he interviewed Vladimir Putin. And why can't we listen to what Vladimir Putin has to say? These people are evil. And then Mitch McConnell follows up. I want you to listen to what he said on Fox just a day after. Let's see. Is he wearing the same tie there? No, it's a different tie. Yeah, so this is the day after he gave that speech saying that Tucker Carlson is the reason that people, which is absolutely ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. My opinion on Ukraine has nothing to do with Tucker Carlson. Quite frankly, I criticized Tucker Carlson in the interview that he did with Vladimir Putin because I didn't think that he was really informed in that interview. But he does. Tucker Carlson has the popularity and he has the ability to bring a platform and to give a platform to people like Vladimir Putin. And again, why? I mean, Chris Wallace interviewed Vladimir Putin. Tons of people have interviewed Vladimir Putin. Why do you have a problem that Tucker Carlson interviewed Vladimir Putin? And why do you have a problem with us listening to what Vladimir Putin has to say? But then Mitch McConnell followed up saying that it's Tucker Carlson's fault that so many Republicans are against the aid to Ukraine, particularly Ukraine, but many Republicans are against all foreign aid. And, you know, with being $35 trillion in debt, it's understandable. This is what Mitch McConnell said the next day.
Is $60 billion enough money for Ukraine to push back Russia decisively?
Well, we hope so.
That's a no.
Actually, only 0.2% of our gross domestic product. So put in that context, it's not a whole lot of money for us.
It's not a whole lot of money. We're $35 trillion in debt. And this guy is saying that $100 billion in foreign aid, not even for us, $100 billion is not a whole lot of money. Do you guys know what $100 billion could do in this country? And I mean, what is this guy talking about? That it's not a whole lot of money, $100 billion. It's not a whole lot of money. So she's asking directly, you know, is this going to be enough for Ukraine to win? Is this going to be enough for them to turn the tide on Russia? He says, we hope so, which means no, this isn't. They're going to come back for more money. They will be back for more money. I promise you, for Ukraine, within a 6-month period, they're going to be requesting more money. I guarantee you, because this is about the military industrial complex.
Is $60 billion enough money for Ukraine to push back Russia decisively?
Well, we hope so. It's actually only 0.2% of our gross domestic product. So put in that context, it's not a whole lot of money for us, but it's a very significant step for them because it gives them the more sophisticated weapons they need to hold the Russians at bay. And we're optimistic. These people are going to win. I mean, the Russians are trying to take their country. And they have enormous incentive. And it doesn't require any of our personnel. We're not getting any Americans killed. We're helping them defend their independence and also degrade the military of one of our biggest adversaries.
You're not degrading anything. You're not degrading anything. So this is what Joe Biden said. You can see the headline in this political article. Biden administration isn't fully convinced Ukraine can win even with new aid. Biden administration isn't fully. Of course, they're not going to win. Of course, they can't win. Of course, this isn't going to help them win. So what is this really about? Zelensky was on Meet the Press with Christian Welker on Sunday. I want you to take a listen to a little bit of this interview.
Well, President Zelensky, it is an historic morning. I want to get your reaction to this major news, the House approving $61 billion in aid to Ukraine. It's expected to pass through the Senate. But you have been asking for this aid for 6 months. In that time, you have run out of ammunition. You've suffered setbacks on the battlefield. Will you get this aid in time to make a difference?
Це дуже важлива річ. По-перше, я хочу подякувати.
Yeah, it's been so important. First of all, I'd like to say thanks to the Congress for the bipartisan support. And I'd like to say thanks to Speaker Johnson and President Biden. Indeed, it is so important, the support from the United States of America. And of course, it's the support of the American people, because of course the political decisions depend on the public opinion.
That's very important. The political decisions depend on public opinion. So even this guy realizes that, of course, you know, that public opinion is everything.
It's the support of the American people, because
and we don't support you, buddy. The American people do not support you. The minority of Americans support you. The majority, just show you this poll that Mammoth University put out just a day or two ago. And you can see from their poll that 43% of the country, that's less than a majority of the country. 43% of the country are in favor of the foreign aid package. 35% of the country are opposed. Break it down by the different parties, 65% of Democrats, and then 14% of Democrats oppose. Independents, 36% of independents, 45% of independents oppose the foreign aid package. More independents oppose the foreign aid package than Republicans. Only 44% of Republicans are opposed to the foreign aid package. 36% of independents are for, 30%. So it's not just Republicans. I want to make that clear. The majority of independents are against foreign aid, and then Republicans, only 14% of Democrats. So maybe that's who you should be thanking. Zelensky is the Democrats, because that's where your public opinion and public support is coming from.
It's the support of the American people, because of course the political decisions depend on the public opinion, and this aid will strengthen Ukraine and send the Kremlin a powerful signal that it will not be the second Afghanistan.
It will send a powerful signal that it would not, that the United States will not be the next Afghanistan. Why is this guy bringing up Afghanistan, people? So get this. Christian Welker, I don't have a lot of respect for her at all. I think that she is a downgrade from Chuck Todd, and that's saying a lot. But just this question alone is very important. And the way that she frames this question, because she's asking him, you know, is this it? You know, is this aid package that Mitch McConnell says is not a whole lot of money for us, $60 billion, we're already giving you over $100 billion. How much more of our money are you going to need? Is this going to be it? And that's the way she frames this question. She asked this question three times because Afghanistan didn't just become Afghanistan overnight. It was year by year. It was a supplemental appropriation by supplemental appropriation. It added up to 20 years. It added up to $2 trillion bit by bit. And this guy says, we're not going to become the next Afghanistan. Oh, really? I'm not too confident about that.
On the public opinion. And this aid will strengthen Ukraine and send the Kremlin a powerful signal that it will not be the second Afghanistan. The United States will stay with Ukraine
or
protect.
So he says send a message to the Kremlin that Ukraine will not be the next Afghanistan. Maybe he's talking about the Russians' invasion of Afghanistan. I'm glad I caught that.
Signal that it will not be the second Afghanistan. The United States will stay with Ukraine, will protect.
It will be the next Afghanistan for us because we're going to stick with you for 20 years and dump another $2 trillion into Ukraine. So it will be Afghanistan for us.
Indeed, it is so important, this support from the United States of America. And of course, it's the support of the American people, because, of course, the political decisions depend on the public opinion. And this aid will strengthen Ukraine and send the Kremlin a powerful signal that it will not be the second Afghanistan. The United States will stay with Ukraine, will protect the Ukrainians, and they will protect, they'll protect democracy in the world. This is the show of leadership and strength of the United States. And I think
he's got all the talking points down.
Now we've reached this important moment. For half a year, we've been waiting, and I would like to say thanks to all the team on my side and on the US side, the team who did everything so that we would get this positive vote. And today, we definitely need this aid. And, Kristen, you know, we really need to get this to the final point. We need to get it approved by the Senate.
Don't worry, buddy. It's coming.
We want to, well, get things as fast as possible so that we get some tangible assistance for the soldiers on the front line as soon as possible, not in another 6 months, so that they would be able to move ahead.
So this is before the Senate passed the appropriations that the House passed on Saturday, and he's like, we need to get this to the finish line. We need these weapons, you know. And she's asking, is this going to be enough aid, or, you know, are we going to be 20 years in Ukraine, $2 trillion like we were in Afghanistan? He says that it will not be another Afghanistan. I'm not sure if he's talking about from our point of view or from the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. Regardless, we were in Afghanistan for 20 years. We spent $2 trillion, and the Taliban is in charge there. Left them tons of equipment, tons of ammunition, and the Taliban is more powerful than ever after 20 years and $2 trillion. So, Christian Welker, the first question she asked is this aid going to help you turn the tide? Are you guys going to start winning now? He doesn't really give her an answer. And then she follows up with this question. Take a listen.
You know, you said this week, President Zelensky, that Ukraine would have no chance of winning without more U.S. support. And I guess The question is, can Ukraine now win this war, or is the United States merely giving you enough aid to prolong this
beautiful
war?
Beautiful question. Beautiful question. Chris, this is the second time she's asked the question. She asked him the first time, is this going to be enough? And then she comes at it another way. Listen, I guess the question that I'm asking, is this enough aid for you to win the war, or is this just going to prolong the war for another 20 years like Afghanistan? Listen to his answer.
Thank you. I think this support will really strengthen the armed forces of Ukraine. And we will have a chance for victory if Ukraine really gets the weapons system, which we need so much.
We need those weapons systems.
Thousands of soldiers need so much. And this aid should not be just spread in thin layer all over, but it has to end up in tangible weapon systems, some really crucial weapon system which are hard to get, the long range artillery. And I really appreciate that it mentions attackams, so long range weapons, and it's important because we need long range weapons to not lose people on the front line, because we have casualties, because we cannot reach that far. Our weapons are not that long range, so we need it. And air defense. This is crucial. These are the priorities now.
We need more.
President Zelensky, as you know, this aid was held up.
So listen, so she's already asked the question twice, and then she comes at it a third time. I was so blown away by this, that she comes at it a third time and asks the same question a different way. How long is this going to take? How long is this going to cost us? Are you going to be able to win now? Is what Kristen wants to know. And this is her third time asking the question. Take a listen.
That far. Our weapons are not that long range, so we
need more.
And air defense.
We need jets.
This is crucial. These are the priorities now.
President Zelensky, as you know, this aid was held up for half a year because there is fierce opposition to sending more aid to Ukraine, particularly amongst some Republicans.
Not just Republicans.
How long should Americans be expected to fund the war in Ukraine?
How much longer? That's pretty direct. How much longer are we going to be asked to fund this thing? How much more money? How much more, Zelensky? How much more do you need? What is, you know, what we've already given you? What can you show us the benefit of that? What's going on? You know, how long is this going to take? Is this going to be another Afghanistan? 20 years, $2 trillion? I mean, what's going on? I'm really impressed with her for asking these questions and sticking to it, asking him, because this guy's trying to, he's trying to not answer the question. She's asked him three times. He's trying to, he keeps saying, we need more. We need air defense. We need long range missiles. We need more, more, more. And so she's asking a third time here, and he doesn't answer still.
You know, this aid was held up for half a year because there is fierce opposition to sending more aid to Ukraine, particularly amongst some Republicans. How long should Americans be expected to fund the war in Ukraine?
The Americans are not funding the war.
Oh, we're not?
In Ukraine. They first and foremost protect freedom and democracy.
We're not funding the war. We're protecting freedom and democracy. Hilarious.
Funding the war. Ukraine. They first and foremost protect freedom and democracy all over Europe. And Ukraine is fighting, and Ukraine is sending its best sons and daughters to the front line, and it reduces the price for all Europe, for all NATO. It reduces the price for everyone, including the U.S. as the leaders in the NATO.
Yeah, so they're going to be coming back for more money. I would say in about 6 months, they're going to be asking, you're going to get another, if Biden wins, you'll get another address. If Trump wins in November, I do believe that he's going to force a peace negotiation. I hope so. I pray so. Hopefully he has not been captured by the military industrial complex, but honestly, nothing would surprise me. The military industrial complex is extremely powerful. Russia says Ukraine will be America's next Vietnam. Russia says after House passes massive bill. And Vietnam, Afghanistan, the relationship, the imagery, these are both wars that we lost. We lost Vietnam. We lost Afghanistan. Saigon is called Ho Chi Minh City to this day. The Taliban is in charge of Kabul to this day and more powerful than ever. We spent billions in Vietnam, billions in Afghanistan, $2 trillion in Afghanistan to be exact. Thousands of lives, and we lost them. Because it's not, no one cares about winning. The winning are the people that are in charge of the military industrial complex. We lose in Afghanistan, but that $2 trillion has to go somewhere. Who's making that money? And that was one of my favorite things about the people talking about the Ukraine aid. Well, it stays in our economy. You know, it helps boost our GDP. Yeah, it goes from the public treasury to private defense contractors. Yes, it helps boost our GDP, but it adds to our national debt. The money goes, we have to borrow the money to go into more debt to give the money to the American defense contractors. Yes, it helps their industry. Yes, it helps our GDP. Yes, there are people that work for the defense contractors that it employs, but at what cost to us? It takes us further into debt. It prolongs and it takes our priorities away from focusing on the United States, building the United States, to tearing down other countries and then rebuilding those countries, because these people are globalists. The military industrial complex is what we were warned about, and this military industrial complex has essentially taken over the public policy here in the United States. And we were warned by Dwight Eisenhower. But again, as the whole reason that I was talking about Nixon and started talking about this, and because I want you to understand what this war in Ukraine is about. It's about selling arms. It's about military industry. That's what it's about. And that's why I started playing and talking about this farewell address that Eisenhower gave in 1961, where he warns that public policy itself. Let's listen to him.
A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new.
It's new
in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political,
spiritual,
even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
So that's what happened. And that's what we're dealing with here in the United States, that the public policy in the United States has been captured by the military-industrial complex. We did not heed this warning from Dwight Eisenhower. And as I've been saying in past podcasts and will further demonstrate today, that by the time Eisenhower was saying this in January of 1961, the military-industrial complex had already been taking control of his administration and was already taking control of public policy. The military-industrial complex was extremely powerful when he was given this speech, and they had already, they were already calling the shots when it came to foreign policy in his administration. And they were doing so with his vice president, which was Richard Nixon, but not only his vice president, his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, and John Foster Dulles's brother, Allen Dulles, who was the head of the Central Intelligence. They both worked while Allen Dulles was the director of Central Intelligence and his brother was the head of the State Department in the Eisenhower administration. Both of these men were working for the law firm Sullivan and Cromwell. This is a New York law firm that they both worked for. And the way that this worked is that these captains of industry, they would go and hire Sullivan and Cromwell, and then these guys, Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles, would do would enact policy based on what the masters of these industry wanted for Sullivan and Cromwell. You also had men like Averell Harriman that were influencing. Again, Averell Harriman was a Democrat, so he had very little influence in the Eisenhower administration. But he was the ambassador again to the Soviet Union at the end of World War II. He was one of the wise men who advised Harry Truman, who advised Franklin Roosevelt, who was also from New York. And we talked about the coup d'etat with Smedley Butler, the business plot, in the last podcast, where they were planning on overthrowing FDR. But again, I bring up Averell Harriman's political affiliation because, I want to be fair about the fact that he was a Democrat, but his friend and fraternity brother at Skull and Bones fraternity brother at Yale, Prescott Bush, was a Republican. And he was a Republican, if you look, a Republican senator from Connecticut from 1952 to 1963. These are the years that Eisenhower was president of the United States. So as Senator Prescott Bush did have some influence on the Eisenhower administration. And Prescott Bush also had influence on the Eisenhower administration through Richard Nixon because, as we showed in the last podcast, and I'll play a little bit of Russ Baker again here, saying how Richard Nixon got his start in politics, how he was found and supported by Prescott Bush, who was part of the Northern industrial elite.
What that was about. And that, again, took me another, you know, 6 months of research and down another rabbit hole. And what I discovered was, just as I had not properly understood the Kennedy assassination, and I might mention, by the way, I had always assumed that Lee Harvey Oswald had been the lone gunman. I really didn't pay any attention to it. Frankly, most journalists know it's a quagmire, and it's just not something, if you want to keep your career on track, that you want to get into. And that goes along with flying saucers. And so I never looked into that. But once I just started discovering the footprints of certain people associated with the intelligence community and associated with George H.W. Bush, I did have a reason. And that was the result, was those four chapters. On the Nixon thing, was the same thing. I had always assumed that Nixon was the bad guy in Watergate. It was just excesses, and that was it. What I discovered again was that we didn't understand our history. And the way I found out about this was I started seeing Poppy Bush's fingerprints on the Watergate story. What I discovered was that the Watergate burglary was not the signature event of this period. It was one of a series of covert operations that look, when you look at them carefully, to have been deliberately bungled. And they were all deliberately bungled in such a shocking way that really you would have to say that these were carefully thought out about how you could bungle this in such a way as to embarrass Richard M. Nixon. And so this forced me to completely see it in a different light. I've got several chapters on this in trying to understand why Richard Nixon would have even favored the Bushes in the first place. I went all the way back and I discovered, much to my astonishment, that the Bush family appears to have played a role in the creation of Richard Nixon. And again, this is not in any of the Richard Nixon biographies, that back in the 1940s, when Richard Nixon first ran for office, Prescott Bush, the grandfather, who was a senator and very, very close with Wall Street interests, was out in Whittier, and they were looking for a candidate to run against the Democrat there, Jerry Voorhees, but not because, as people said, because Jerry Voorhees was a liberal. The reason they apparently wanted somebody to run against him was because Jerry Voorhees was worried about Wall Street. Does this sound familiar? He was afraid, you know, after the Great Depression, that maybe we needed some more regulation. Maybe the maybe Wall Street was out of control. Maybe it was lacked transparency, and it needed more regulation and more oversight. And so Jerry Voorhees was the leading person for oversight of Wall Street and banking, and they took him out with Richard M. Nixon. And so Richard M. Nixon, as best as I'm able to ascertain, was beholden to the Bush family, and this is why he gave them all of these appointments. But once he got in office, he seems to have decided, you know, I'm the president now. The president can do what he wants, and I'm not going to let these people tell me what to do anymore. And I describe in great detail here all of the things he did that angered the oil industry, things he did that angered the military-industrial complex, things he did that angered big companies of all different types.
Listen to what he says. The things that he did to anger the oil industry, the military industrial complex industry. And then he says, what does he say here? The oil industry, the military industrial complex industry.
The oil industry, things he did that angered the military industrial complex, things he did that angered big companies.
Big companies.
Of all different types.
Of all different types.
That angered the CIA.
And then the CIA. All the things he did to anger the big companies, the big industrialists, and then the CIA. Because the CIA, Alan Dulles, working for Sullivan and Cromwell, they basically, the industrialists were in charge of the CIA through Alan Dulles and his brother, who's Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower, John Foster Dulles, and Richard Nixon, because Richard Nixon was controlled by Prescott Bush. Now, the story that Russ Baker is telling here is how Richard Nixon made George H.W. Bush, how Richard Nixon strategically put George H.W. Bush, as you're going to see here in a moment, in a position where he can even be president of the United or vice president of the United States to Ronald Reagan, and then become president of the United States. Every thing politically that George H.W. Bush George Herbert Walker Bush, his whole political career is owed to Richard Nixon. And what Russ Baker is saying is that the reason that Richard Nixon put George H.W. Bush in the position to where one day he can be president of the United States is because he owed that to Richard Nixon the Bush family, because Prescott Bush is the one who made Richard Nixon's political career. There would be no President George H.W. Bush without Richard Nixon, but there would be no Richard Nixon without Prescott Bush. Understand what I'm saying? Tucker Carlson, this is the reason that Mitch McConnell was blaming Tucker Carlson, because Tucker Carlson, over the past few years, and especially since he left Fox News, has been on this transformation. And I have watched this guy, followed his career, going back to Bowtie Tucker. Remember when he used to wear the bow tie on CNN? I mean, I remember who this guy used to be. Didn't care for him at all. But, I mean, you're watching now. He's doing all these podcast interviews, like this one with Joe Rogan. He's out there being very clear about this transformation that he's made and how ashamed that he was, that he ever doubted people who questioned 9/11. He is ashamed that he ever supported the war in Iraq. And I have a lot of respect for Tucker Carlson now, because he's being honest about the fact and saying, I was wrong. And now he's using his voice to correct those things. He's using his show. That's why he was kicked off of Fox. This is why Mitch McConnell has a problem with Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson just did a podcast with Joe Rogan. I guess it was a week ago. And they start talking about Nixon and what happened to Nixon. And Tucker Carlson is going to say exactly what Russ Baker said here. And I want you to listen to what Tucker Carlson, the way Tucker Carlson frames it.
I mean, if you look at what happened to Richard Nixon, which I, of course, did not understand at all. Richard Nixon was taken out by the FBI and CIA, and with the help of Bob Woodward, who was a Washington Post reporter who had been a naval intelligence officer working in the White House, working in the Nixon White House. And then he shows up like a year later, and he's this brand new reporter. He'd never been a journalist at all. He's a naval intel officer, the famous Bob Woodward we all revere. And he's at the Washington Post, and somehow he gets the biggest story in the history of the Washington Post. He's the lead guy in that story. Well, I worked at a newspaper. I've been in the news business my whole life. That is not how it works. You don't take a kid like his first day from a totally unrelated business and put him on the biggest story. But he was. He was that guy. And who is his main source for Watergate? Oh, the number two guy at the FBI. Oh, so you have the naval intelligence officer working with the FBI official to destroy the president. Okay, so that's a deep state coup. What else? How would you describe that? If that happened in Guatemala, what would you say? And yet the way it was framed and the way that I accepted for decades was, oh, this intrepid reporter fought power. No, no, no. This intrepid reporter, Bob Woodward, was a tool of power, secret power, which is the most threatening kind, to bounce the single most popular president in American history, Richard Nixon, from office before the end of his term, and replace him with who? Oh, Gerald Ford, who sat on the Warren Commission. Now, how did Gerald Ford get to be Richard Nixon's vice president? Well, because Carl Albert, the Democrat Speaker of the House, told him, you must choose him. We will only confirm him when they sent the actual elected vice president away for tax evasion, Spiro Agnew of Maryland. So you have a complete setup, like an absolute – Gerald Ford, the only unelected president in American history, actually sat on the Warren Commission. Something else that I accepted at face value until I looked at it, and I was like, that's completely insane.
Why was Gerald Ford on the Warren Commission? For that matter, why was Alan Dulles on the Warren Commission? The Warren Commission was a complete fraud. This guy, Alan Dulles, was on the Warren Commission. Gerald Ford were on the Warren Commission. Everything that Tucker Carlson is saying here is 100% right. They forced Richard Nixon to put Gerald Ford in the administration as vice president after they got rid of Spiro Agnew. So, and then Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission. So then they force Richard Nixon to resign, or he's going to be impeached after they find the tapes. Listen to what Russ Baker says here.
When you start examining all these people, you start finding them all connected to Poppy Bush and all having their own intelligence connections, including the man who discovered and told the Senate committee about the taping system.
So so from the intelligence community, that's how they learn about the taping system. And if you know anything about Richard Nixon, it was the taping system that took him out. They forced him. So the important thing you got to understand is that they forced him first to pick Gerald Ford, who Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission, congressman from Michigan, from the Ford family, the Ford name. And then Gerald Ford becomes president. Now, at this time, George H.W. Bush, who owes his entire political career to Richard Nixon, because Richard Nixon owes his political career to George H.W. Bush's father, Prescott Bush. At this time, Richard Nixon had put George H.W. Bush in the position of he was the chairman of the RNC. So that was the height of his political career at that time as the chairman of the RNC. All of that political advancement of George H.W. Bush is because of Richard Milhouse Nixon. But then Gerald Ford comes in, and one of the first things Gerald Ford does is this event called the Halloween Massacre. Halloween Massacre is a term associated with a major reorganization of the United States President Gerald Ford's cabinet in November 1975. And what was this reorganization of the administration after Ford becomes the President of the United States because they force Richard Nixon to pick Gerald Ford as his vice president? What was this overhaul and this shakeup in his cabinet? The changes were Henry Kissinger was replaced by Brent Scowcroft as the national security advisor. So they get rid of Henry Kissinger, who was loyal to Richard Nixon. William Kobe, who's William Kobe? Says right here, was the American intelligence officer who served as DCI Director of Central Intelligence from September 1973 to January 1996. So in this massacre, this firing that Gerald Ford does when he first comes in, he gets rid of William Kobe. Now, why is William Kobe important? Because of the Church Committee. William Kobe was the director of Central Intelligence during the Church Committee. And the Church Committee is when the CIA had to give up what is called the family jewels. And William Kobe, the director of Central Intelligence, gave up the family jewels, gave up all of the secrets on the CIA during the Church Committee. So he had sold out the family, the corporation, William Kobe. So that's why one of the first things that President Ford, who they forced Richard Nixon to pick as his vice president, one of the first things he does is he gets rid of William Kobe, who gave away the family jewels, the corporation secrets in the Church Committee. And who does Gerald Ford replace William Kobe with as director of Central Intelligence? He replaces him with George Herbert Walker Bush. And then what are some other changes that took place in the Halloween massacre by Gerald Ford once he became president, once they forced Richard Nixon to resign? Take a look at this. James Schlesinger was replaced as chief of staff by who? Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld. And then Rumsfeld, he was the Secretary of Defense. Rumsfeld's deputy, Vice President Dick Cheney, became the new chief of staff, moved up to chief of staff. Dick Cheney, Liz Cheney's father, in the Halloween massacre, they got rid of all of these cabinet members from the Nixon administration, and they replaced them with Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, George Bush. I mean, do you understand what was going on here? So, Richard Nixon, as vice president to Dwight Eisenhower, like I said, the military-industrial complex had already taken over Dwight Eisenhower's administration with tons of secret operations around the world. If you look here, if you look at Alan Dulles, who also sat on the Warren Commission, it says that during the early Cold War, he oversaw the Iranian coup in 1953, the Guatemalan coup in 1954. So they were going around the world staging all these coup d'etats for private industries in the United States, coup d'etats and everything. And who was overseeing all of these coup d'etats that were going on? So you have to understand that in the CIA, if you look at the CIA building there in Langley, not everybody in the building knows what's going on with every single operation. These operations are compartmentalized, and there's certain groups that do certain operations. Well, there is a group within the CIA, Special Activities Center, or SOG, Special Operations Group, and the Special Operations Group is the special group that would go around doing these coup d'etats, like the coup d'etat in Iran and the coup d'etat in Guatemala. Look, you see the picture here of Eisenhower, and this is Dulles' brother, John Foster Dulles. They're staging all of this. The one that they did in Guatemala, they did it for Dole fruit or American fruit to steal Guatemalan fruit for Dole fruit industry. They did it in Iran to steal Iran's oil for British Petroleum. So the group within the CIA that was doing all these special operations is the Special Operations Group, SOG, or Special Activities Center. The person who oversaw these operations in the Eisenhower administration was the vice president, Richard Nixon. He was the one. Look at this one. Operation 40. We're going to talk a little bit about this here in a moment. But Operation 40, let's read this. Operation 40 was codenamed for a Central Intelligence-sponsored counterintelligence group composed of Cuban exiles. The group was formed to seize control of the Cuban government after the Bay of Pigs invasion. Operation 40 continued to operate unofficially until disbanded in 1970 due to allegations that an aircraft was carrying cocaine and heroin in support of the group and crashed in California. So the CIA has been in the drug business for a long time. Watching this show right now, it's an FX show called Snowfall, and this show is about how we were talking about the war in Nicaragua in the 1980s in the last podcast. I played the clip of Ronald Reagan, and I told you that because of the Boland Amendment that Congress stopped all funding to the Contras in Nicaragua, and that the CIA, because Bill Casey, who was the director of Central Intelligence during the Reagan administration, and Reagan. It was very important to them to keep funding the Contras. So they started selling cocaine here in the United States during the crack cocaine epidemic. Most of the cocaine that fueled the crack cocaine epidemic was coming from the CIA. So the Operation 40 says that the Operation 40 was disbanded in 1970s because they found an aircraft full of cocaine. So the CIA being in the drug business and using drugs to fund their special activities, because these special activities, special operations are a lot of times done outside of the purview of Congress. So they're not funded these special operations. So these special operations need to be funded. So sometimes you have to sell cocaine to your people so you can fund these special operations. But Richard Nixon was in charge of the special operations group that the CIA were running under Allen Dulles. And Richard Nixon was, when he ran in 1960 against John Kennedy, the CIA was really expecting and preparing for Richard Nixon to win the presidency. And they had Bay of Pigs invasion already planned, already set to go, that after the election, once Richard Nixon won, because he had been overseeing, you know, all of their operations throughout the Eisenhower administrations, they were expecting him to win, and that when he won, that he would immediately approve the Bay of Pigs operation. Nixon didn't win. Nixon lost in 1960, and John Kennedy won, a very close race. Look at the numbers here. 34,220,984 votes to 34,108,000. I mean, just over 100,000 votes is how many votes separated these two by. I mean, it was one of the closest races in American history. But Richard Nixon loses, and the CIA had been anticipating that he would win, so he would green light the Bay of Pigs invasion. And I want you to listen to a little bit more of the interview here with Tucker Carlson, and then I have maybe one last clip that I'm going to play, and then we'll pick this up on Friday. Listen to Tucker Carlson here.
Richard Nixon was elected by more votes than any president in American history in the 1972 election. He was the most popular by votes, which is the only way we can really measure popularity, the most popular president in his reelection campaign. And 2 years later, he's gone, undone by a naval intel officer, the number two guy at the FBI, and a bunch of CIA employees. You tell me what that is. Those are the facts. Those are not disputed facts. That's not crackpot shit. That's just look it up.
So why did they want to get rid of Nixon?
You know, there are a lot of theories on that. I mean, we don't need to know motive to know what happened. They, meaning unelected federal employees, got rid of Richard Nixon, which is the most anti-democratic way to make a leadership change that there is. Okay. I should just say at the outset, I actually kind of believe in democracy. Obviously, it's not working well. Obviously, it's ending globally. There will never be another liberal democracy, unfortunately. But I'm attached to it because I was born here. I really believe in it. And it's better than any other system. So that's why I'm pissed. What was their motive? There are a lot of theories on this. There's an amazing conversation. It's on tape between Richard Nixon when he was still president. I think it was in 1973. And I think it was Richard Helms, the head of the CIA, though I may have fucked that up. But it was the head of the CIA. And I think it was Helms. And Nixon says, I know why they killed Jack Kennedy. So Nixon was a student of history, obviously a flawed and complicated person, but a very, very smart person. And he was really interested in why this guy who'd been president, just one president before him, was murdered.
Of course he knows why they killed Jack. He knows why they killed Jack because he knows the people who did it. He was working with them. He was working with them in the Eisenhower administration. Of course he knows who killed Jack. I'm not going to play the actual phone or conversation. It's a tape conversation between Richard Nixon and Richard Helms in the Oval Office that Tucker Carlson was just making reference to. But this is a clip completely dramatized. This conversation likely never happened, but this is from the Oliver Stone movie that he did about Nixon. And if you know Oliver Stone's filmography, he's told this entire story. He's done the story about, you know, the movie about W. Bush. He was at Yale at the same time as George W. Bush. He did Scarface about the Cubans in the cocaine business. He did Nixon. He did the JFK movie, particularly focusing. We're going to talk about Oliver Stone's JFK movie because he focuses on the trial in New Orleans, the Garrison trial in New Orleans of Clay Shaw. And it's I'm going to talk to you in the next podcast about why Oliver Stone told that story from that perspective of that trial in New Orleans. But this is from the Oliver Stone, the movie Nixon. This is a conversation in this movie that Nixon is having with CIA director Richard Helms that Tucker Carlson was just talking about. The conversation that Tucker Carlson was talking about is a real tape, audio tape conversation. The audio is not that great, so I'm not going to play it, but it's along these lines. Take a listen.
Is there something else that's bothering you, Mr. President?
Yes. It involves some old and forgotten papers, things I signed as vice president. I want the originals in my office, and I don't want copies anywhere else.
You're referring, I believe, to chairing the Special Operations Group as vice president.
Yeah.
As you know, that was unique. Not an operation so much as an organic phenomenon. It grew, it changed shape, it developed appetites. It's not unusual in such cases that things are not committed to paper. That could be very embarrassing. I, for one, saw to it that my name was never connected with any of these operations. ZM. Trujillo. Lumumba. Guatemala. Iran. Cuba. It's a shame you didn't take similar precautions, Dick.
All right, so I'm way over.
In those documents that put your people together with the gangster elements.
Gangster elements. All right, guys. So I'll get back into this in the next podcast. And hopefully I can end this in the next podcast. I don't plan on going too deep into this, but I want you to understand that what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in this country, that we have been captured by not only the military-industrial complex, but the masters of industry. We failed to listen to the warning that Dwight Eisenhower was giving us on his way out of office, and we're in a lot of trouble, people. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend.